So, you know, we're all obviously, as the entire Jewish world, and you know, people of good faith from all walks of life, are deeply troubled and distressed. You know, here on this last day of Hanukkah, about the developments you know, regarding anti-Semitism. This is a process that, of course, goes back at least 14 months, but probably even before that, to Charlottesville, Pittsburgh, Poway, North Miami Beach, and, you know, the sense of it, you know, drawing closer and closer in terms of Jersey City, then Teaneck, Muncie. These are obviously all different scales, a different intensity, but, you know, we're experiencing something that is obviously momentous and very, very concerning. I wanted to begin with a simple question based on a halacha, and hopefully then try to, you know, reflect a little bit together with you and then come back to the question. There is a Gemara in Shabbos which actually deals with Hanukkah, the Hamisavian Daf Chav Gimel, and the Gemara says, Hamadlik, a person who lights Hanukkah candles should say a bracha, which isn't so obvious because, of course, it's a rabbinic commandment, and when it comes to rabbinic commandments, how exactly do you say, Baruch HaTashem B'lkenim El-Cholam, that God commanded us to do it if it came from the rabbis? So there's different answers to that question. One of them is that the Torah itself told us that we're not supposed to stray from what the rabbis told us. That's the Rambam's preferred interpretation. The Ramban disagrees. And we'll return to this in just a moment. But he says the proper source text is actually found in Parshas Hazinu at the very end of the Torah, that in general we're supposed to have this orientation of listening and inquiring of the sages. Then the Gemara goes on to say, this is in the name of Rabbi Yirmiyah, the first is a statement in the name of Rav, that a person who sees the Hanukkah candles actually has to make a bracha, and that's the bracha of Shasa Nisim Avosenu Bayamim Ahim Bazman Azeh. And I'd like to just flag this issue of what exactly is the nature of this bracha, right? It's not a what we call a birchas hamitzvah. It's not a blessing on the commandment. There's no asher ki deshanu v'tzav v'tzivanu. The only other time we make it is actually when we read the Megillah, right? And we make it before reading the Megillah, so it's actually contemporaneous, you know, with the birchas hamitzvah there, you know, al mikra Megillah. And here in the context of Hanukkah candles, at least in theory, even though, of course, our practice is to combine them, it sounds like, from the Gemara, and there are many actually who do maintain this as the halachic position, that one would be obligated at least once to say this bracha simply upon seeing, you know, the Hanukkah candles. Let's say one didn't have an opportunity to light Hanukkah candles, but one saw them, one indeed would be obligated to make this bracha. So the question really is, what is the nature of this bracha, what we call the birchas haroah? How should we understand it? You see the Hanukkah candle, you have to recite a blessing, so we hopefully we'll return to that in about 15 minutes or so. And let's try to develop some perspective. So I think you know, the pasuk that we just referenced, Shalavicha v'yagedcha zekinecha v'yomrlach, is a good place to start. The beginning of that pasuk starts as follows: Zechor yemos olam binu shnos dor vador, that we have to have a sense of history. A historical perspective. And the reason that that's so important, especially when thinking about current events, is that as troubling and disturbing and all that is true, what we're experiencing is right now, we have to understand that the anomaly is not what's taking place now, but the anomaly is what we were all acculturated to experience, and having been raised over the course of the last number of decades, you know, in this particular diaspora. But if you would ask, you know, what is the norm of Jewish history and what is the anomaly of Jewish history? So the anomaly, obviously, is everything that we'd experienced up until now. Now, that in and of itself is not meant to be a reassuring thought, but it's extremely important for us, you know, to be cognizant of that. It's not as if, like, the natural state of events, you know, is for us, you know, to sort of move swimmingly through the various environments in which we found ourselves. And a major part of the shock and horror that we experience, and it is appropriate to experience this, has to do with the fact that, you know, what seems completely extraordinary to us would have been anything but for our ancestors. That is an extremely important perspective to have. It doesn't make it more acceptable. And again, one of the main things that we have to avoid right now is becoming numb to it and saying, like, oh, okay, so, you know, it's just an attack. Okay, only one person was killed. Only, you know, it could have been worse. You know, that is a very dangerous phenomenon that can happen very quickly, you know. And I remember, I have not traveled extensively, but I'm married to somebody who has. So, I remember not even a few years ago, she's taking a trip through Europe. And, my wife was commenting about, the concept of a fortress shul, right? Which is, just de rigueur in Europe. That is the standard. You know, and thinking, somewhat smugly to myself, it's like a little strange. You know, we have a state of Israel, thank God. You know, why wouldn't people just go? You know, that people really want to live like this. And what you see is that it just happens, like slowly but surely. And now our shul is a fortress. There are so many layers of security that are involved. I mean, hard layers of security, security personnel. There's county police. There's municipal police. There's our own security volunteers. There's private security. I mean, I'm not even going to get into all the details because I can't. But this is something that literally spend, a huge amount of time on, every single week. And so you see how you've just become acculturated to it. Now it's just part of my job. It's part of my life. You know, when I was in rabbinical school, we spent a grand total of 0 minutes talking about, how a rabbi should organize his security team, okay? And now I spend literally hours on it literally every single week because, what could be more important than the safety of the people come to daven with us? So again, it's a very humbling thing in life to become what you scoffed at not that long ago. But you see how then it becomes a creeping phenomenon. You say, okay, so it's okay. Our shuls will be fortresses. Our schools will be fortresses. Yeah. Every now and again, somebody's going to make a kind of, menacing attack. But this is just a part of things. So that's important to be aware of as well as, how the process of normalization takes place. Okay, so that's just that's one observation. Second observation, which I think is very, very important, if we want to trace this back to Pittsburgh, just for organizations, you could probably think about it in a broader way, but certainly that was a watershed moment, and I think in retrospect we even appreciate more. And we're only talking about something, we're talking about October 2018, so we're not talking 10 years ago. We're talking 14 months ago. You think the Tree of Life congregation? I think basically is a Reform congregation. If you think about Poway, that was a Chabad congregation. If you think about Jersey City, so that's a certain sect of Hasidim that is sort of relocated from the, from the five boroughs, into Jersey City. Now you think about, Muncie. This is a lesson that we learned over and again historically. From the perspective of those, who would, seek to annihilate us, it's just not a very profound distinction, whether it's the Tree of Life congregation or the Chabad of Poway, people who, are observant or not observant, or people in Muncie or people in Jersey City. So, sometimes it's extremely important for us to remember, which is not to say sometimes people take this in the wrong direction and they say, okay, and therefore it doesn't matter what choices people make. That's not the message. But when it comes to, how we think about anti-Semitism, what is absolutely of the essence is to stand with the united front because we are all targeted in exactly the same way. And it is of zero consequence to, again, the people who perpetrate these very horrific and very cowardly acts, how personally observant somebody is or is not, and that I think has always been true. I think that's always been true, and I think that this last 14 months has really underscored that point. So again, point number one is Zechor Yemo Sulam Binush Nos Dor V'Dor, as we have to have a sense of history and how fortunate we are that we're shocked by these things. Okay, that's number one. Again, number two is, I think we see very, very, very clearly the patterns of history replaying themselves in terms of, how anti-Semitism expresses itself and distinctions that might seem, very, very, very significant and can be very significant when we're dealing with internal issues really cannot be those distinctions cannot be significant and should not be taken into account, when it comes to, when it comes to anti-Semitism. I remember, and nobody, this isn't just, the benefit of retrospect and hindsight, but I think probably some people here did, make note at the time of the Tree of Life attack, some extremely vulgar and totally unacceptable remarks that were made about, oh, you know, the reason that this congregation was attacked was because, you know, there's certain practices that go on there, you know, that they tolerate certain things. I think there happened to have been a circumcision from a same-sex couple there that morning, and, you know, people with an agenda use that. And, of course, you know, it tells you everything about them and nothing about the people who were attacked, that they should say such a thing, you know, because, again, since then, you know, the people in Jersey City, the people in Muncie who don't, you know, practice anything like the people in Tree of Life, you know, have been targeted precisely the same way. And I think that's extremely important for us to keep in mind at this time. So I would say that's, you know, that's a broad point, number two. You know, point number three, think about, you know, when it comes to reflecting on the last 14 months, but especially in the context of Hanukkah, is that, you know, Hanukkah is obviously the last of our holidays, if you will. You know, Hanukkah is not even reflected in the Torah Shebichsav. It doesn't have a Sefer in Tanakh. It wasn't granted, and we could, you know, speak at length about why this might have been the case, but it wasn't granted its own section in the Mishnah, even though there's plenty of material. There's at least as much material when it comes to Hanukkah to talk about as there is, you know, Purim, which did get its own Masechta, which didn't get its own Sefer in Tanakh. But one of the real themes of Hanukkah, and you don't even have to look any further than Ma'oz Tzur. Anybody know offhand how many stanzas there are in Ma'oz Tzur? There's six, if you count Chasov Zeroa Kotshecha. How many of them are about the events of Hanukkah themselves? One, exactly, right? Yivanim Nikbitzu Alai. So what actually is the first a general opening statement about God as our, you know, our fortress and our salvation, and then we start tracing through Jewish history, right? So we start talking about, you know, bondage in Egypt and salvation, then we start talking about the establishment of the first commonwealth and, right, the fact that the Babylonians came in and destroyed it, and what we call Shivat Zion, Kates Bavel, Zerubbabel, Kates Shivim Noshati, 70-year period, and then we talk about the oppression of the Persian Empire, then we actually get to the Greeks, Yivanim Nikbutsu Alai, and then we speak more broadly about God's ultimate salvation, Chasov Zeroa Kadshecha. So one of the ideas, you know, really about Hanukkah, is that it was meant and very carefully calibrated and designed as the holiday that would carry us through our diaspora. There was a very clear cognizance of this. And that, you know, the flames of the Hanukkah candles would represent, you know, whatever ideological oppression we came under. Any time there was an attempt, whether again it was the Hellenists or, you know, modern day iterations. So what the Hanukkah candles are really meant to represent is the idea of the eternality and the perpetuation of our Masorah, of our tradition, in the face of, you know, hostile you know, antagonism, whether it's ideological antagonism like the Hellenists, or whether it happens to be, you know, physical hostility and violence. The Hanukkah was very carefully designed that way, to be able to speak to the entire, you know, diaspora, which is appropriate since it's the last, and it was very clear that it would be the last. That's why, again, like, just to take one small example, in the Ma'oz Tzur, we talk very little about Hanukkah per se, and what we try to do is we try to think about it, you know, in the span of Jewish history. And I think that, you know, one of the most important motifs that the rabbis wove into our experience of Hanukkah was really just that. It was a sense of the need to be courageous. We talk about things like, you know, Rabim Biad Ma'atim, that, you know, small numbers, but, you know, able to achieve very significant things, which, if you think about it, you know, people always talk about the differences between the military victory and the you know, the miracle of the oil. But they're actually just two sides of the same coin, because what's it really about? Something very small, right, that is able to sort of punch above its weight, something that's able to do something that it should not have been able to do in a quantitative sense. That's really the idea of Hanukkah. So you take a small cruise of oil, and all of a sudden it's lasting for 8 days. You take a very small band of soldiers, and they're able to defeat the mightiest empire in the world. It's two sides of the same coin. It's really one idea. Okay, and what makes that possible from our point of view is the fact that we're not doing it on our own, but we're doing it, of course, you know, with the assistance of He who has been our fortress and our salvation, you know, from time immemorial. So when the Rambam, let's say, when he opens up his discussion of Hilchos Chanukah, he writes it in a very particular way. He says, during the Second Commonwealth, when the Greeks oppressed us and they, you know, tried to abolish the Jewish religion, there was financial oppression. They also took advantage of Jewish women in a particularly heinous way. And Jewish people suffered terribly under this kind of oppression. Ad shirichem aleihem Elohei avoseinu, until God had compassion on us, v'hoshiyem miyadam, and he saved us, v'gavru b'nei chashmonai kohanim agadolim, and the Hasmoneans became victorious and triumphant, v'hoshiyu Yisrael miyadam, and they saved the Jewish people. So the Rambam uses the same language twice within the space of one sentence. What he says is that, you know, the Hasmoneans saved the Jewish people. He says, v'hoshiyu Yisrael miyadam. But the sentence before that is, he said, Ad shirichem aleihem Elohei avoseinu v'hoshiyem miyadam. So he's actually using the same expression twice. So what he wants us to understand is that this small band, again, it was just a family, right? And, you know, whoever joined them was able to be successful because, obviously, they weren't fighting on their own. But as, you know, David HaMelech said in his own inimitable way, you know, Elu v'recha v'elu v'asusim v'anachnu b'shem Hashem Elokeinu nazkir, is that we have this abiding sense of faith that, you know, of course we have to do everything in our power. We're not doing it on our own. We're doing it within the context of divine assistance. And I think that is really the ultimate message of Chanukah. It requires great bravery to be amongst the Chashmonaim, to take that step, to be, you know, one of the few that's prepared to take on the many. But if we do so, we do so with the knowledge that we're really not doing this alone. And so, you know, to bring things full circle, this is a very new experience for us as a community, as an American Jewish community, but it is not a new experience for us nationally. And we have an enormous amount of historical experience to draw upon. The resolve and the resilience that was demonstrated, you know, throughout the ages, incredible courage of different kinds, courage of the martial sort to be prepared to fight, courage of the spiritual sort to be prepared to risk life and limb for the perpetuation of that which, you know, our adversaries seek to destroy in terms of, you know, our values. And we should not think ourselves unequal to that task. I think, on the contrary, we should think of ourselves as the very proud heirs of this legacy of courage and being willing to, so to speak, fight against the odds, because we know that, you know, ultimately the odds are with us in the sense of the ultimate moving force of the universe being entirely within, you know, behind us and obviously in our corner. And with that, I think it's perhaps in light of that that we can understand why Chazal said that there's actually a chiyuv, there's a halachic obligation to make a bracha when one sees the Chanukah candles. They'll say, you weren't the one to light them. But when you see those candles and you understand that what those candles represent is not just the spiritual resilience in one generation, right, over the Greeks, but as we pointed out about Chanukah, what it really represents is spiritual resilience throughout the ages, then that is a moment when you see that, you must affirm that. You must say, I believe, you know, that's not just, you know, some historical, you know, relic, but that this represents the idea that God, you know, has taken a solemn oath to not just preserve the Jewish people, but that the Jewish people will be able to maintain the Torah through, you know, all kinds of oppression that is unimaginable to us, even as we experience things that we have not personally experienced before. There's a direct halachic analog, as a matter of fact. The first Mishnah in the last chapter of Masech Debrachos says that when a person passes a place where a miracle happened, he has to make a bracha that God did a miracle for him, b'makom hazeh, or for his family. It's actually the same idea, right? That what you have to do is not just express gratitude for, you know, what happened, but you have to identify that. You have to see yourself as, you know, being here only because of what transpired then. And so just like we have the concept of a bracha, shasa nisim la'avoseinu, you know, b'makom hazeh, so we have basically the temporal version of that spatial bracha, which is Shasanisam Avosena Bayami Mahim Bazman Hazet. It's the same idea. And so, you know, that's really as we bid farewell to Hanukkah, Tafshin Pei 5780. It's very important for us to go out with that bracha very much on our minds. This is a moment for all of its travails and for all of its difficulty. This is a moment when we get to be part of Jewish history in a way that American Jews historically, you know, have not been able to really identify with and to appreciate so much more the resilience that has been demonstrated throughout the ages. I would say this is a Chanukah of the Birchas HaRoah more than anything else, and to be filled with a sense of total conviction. You know, Shasanisim Lavosenu Bayamim Ahim Bazman Hazeh, that the flames that we kindled, you know, they are deeply symbolic, and they reflect again a kind of a bottomless reserve of spiritual resolve, something that could match that original cruise of oil and a small group of family members who understood the right thing and were very courageous. So we can and should be too. Not just to be afraid. You know, there's some amount of fear that's perfectly understandable, but I think that we should understand that this is a moment that has been thrust upon us. We didn't go looking for it, but to be extremely proud of our history of defiance and of resilience and of perseverance, and to try to do our best, just like the Roah has to identify with a candle that was lit. So we have to do our best to hold up the bargain of Bazman Hazeh in this generation, and to make sure that we're projecting a sense of optimism, and obviously we're going to be responsible, and we're going to take all precautions, and we're not going to be cavalier about anything, but to project a sense of optimism that there are many stanzas to Mao's Tzur, and it all comes to the same place, that we've gone through a lot, but we've always been there to tell the story in the end. And if you just go down those lists of, the Egyptian Empire, and then the Babylonian Empire, and then the Persian Empire, and then the Greek Empire, so they're not here to see, they're not celebrating a holiday right now when the Jews just represent one of their stanzas. It's the other way around. I think we should all be filled with a sense of deep faith and optimism. And by that, and God willing, hopefully we can project that to our children, to our students. Caution is appropriate, but a sense of dread and fear, would not be in keeping with that historical tradition that we should be so proud of. Okay. Carol, yeah, of course.
So.